This is episode 7 of the Rhode Island Liberty Report. In this episode, we talk about the state of the state, Raimondo's cannabis legalization proposal, South Kingstown school board drama, and school choice. Let's get on with the show.
Welcome to the Rhode Island Liberty Report, your source for libertarian commentary on current events in the Ocean State and Southern New England. Coming to you from Rothbard Studios, here are your hosts, Mike and Eric.
Welcome to the Rhode Island Liberty Report from LibertyRI.com. I'm Mike, and in the studio with me, as always, is my co-host Eric, ready to tackle the latest issues here in Rhode Island. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How you doing, Mike? I'm feeling better. I'm feeling not dead.
That was
feeling last week after a bout of with a flu-like mystery virus of
right.
some kind.
And again, I was going to attempt to do the podcast on my own, and it just didn't work out. So I will apologize to the audience for not getting one out last week. But sickness is sickness, and it is what it is.
That's right. I will say I do appreciate my privatized health insurance. It is amazing that I can go to the doctor and get all this tests done, get looked at, and get all this expert medical advice for a $10 copay and my monthly premium, which is not crazy. And to me, it's like people complain about the healthcare costs. It's when you actually have to go to the doctor, it ends up being pretty cheap.
Right.
If you're healthy, obviously, then you're just like, oh, I'm paying for nothing. But yeah. When you finally get sick, you're like, well, I'm really happy I've got this. So
I gotcha. So just a little bit of housekeeping. We I've been getting some good feedback. I've ran into a couple of friends that have listened to the podcast, and they've been giving us positive feedback. And we want feedback. So always give us feedback, good or bad. We just want to get better. So I think as we're on episode, 7 now. So as the show goes on, I think we'll get more comfortable doing this. It's a little awkward at first. No lie. I'm not going to lie there. But it's not our professional day jobs, right? We're not, radio hosts or anything like that. So any feedback always on either on Facebook directly, and you'll give all that information out at the end, as you always do. And one other thing I want to do is I want to give credit to one of our Facebook page moderators, John, who's been with me at Liberty RI since pretty much, very early on, with his awesome memes lately. He's been busting out the memes, and they've been making me laugh.
Mostly Gina memes.
Yeah, Gina memes.
She's a great, a muse. She's a meme muse.
Yeah.
You know, for John, especially, I think. And he has been crushing on those, man. I'm dying laughing when I'm seeing these things. Like, it's cracking me up.
The latest one was also the signs, the Rhode Island sign. And it was like, welcome to Rhode Island, come for the free college, stay for the free ride. Or something.
That's actually a really good slogan.
Yeah.
I don't know. They should use it. I mean, it's perfectly descriptive of what the way things are. And it also sounds good. So, right. John, bravo.
Yeah. Yeah. So, speaking of Gina.
Gina,
a little segue
with
there.
Her state of the state address, it's so funny because I used to, when I was younger and I was really into politics and stuff, I used to eat this stuff up for dinner. Like the State of the Union, man, I used to get so excited to watch it, and the pomp and the circumstance and all this crap that they do, and the motions they go through, and basically the state of the state goes through the same motions as they do in the State of the Union, right? It's they lead in all the judges, and they all sit down, and then there's the whole administration, and then she comes in and blah, 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 and the trumpets are blaring, and she gets up there, and it's a huge just socialist nightmare, basically, what came out of her mouth. I think the one thing that she said in the entire speech, where I actually thought that she was right on, was when she said that the state of the state was, I believe she said it was stronger than ever. And you know what? If we're talking about, when we say the state, if we're talking about the government itself, she's absolutely right. The government is stronger than ever. It's more powerful than ever. It's more heavily funded than ever. It's more intrusive than ever. She is absolutely 1,000% correct. If she's talking about the geographical area of Rhode Island that we all inhabit, and the marketplace and our sort of voluntary associations with each other, it's the complete opposite. It's weaker than ever. It's fledgling, it's stagnant, and I mean, just all the sources that she gave in terms of trying to prove our economic prosperity during her time is just such bunk. You know, what was your sort of general impression?
Yeah, like? No, I watched it. I grabbed it on through the stream online, and which was fun because I was watching all the comments, and it was just, again, I'm wondering where all these people are when it comes time to vote, because the comments were almost 100% negative that I saw. You know, about every time she would mention a new tax, a new service, a new service, which comes with a new tax. It was just people were saying another tax, another tax. I mean, it was just nonstop. I didn't see much support on the live stream, and it was just infuriating as she ticked off her list of, you know, government programs and government restrictions that she was getting at. It just was another beatdown. It was just this impending, you know, feeling of impending doom. And I've never heard anything that extreme. Maybe because it's her last term and she doesn't care. She's not running for a re-election. So now she can even get more extreme. I don't know, but it was mind-boggling.
Yeah. And I think that it really was probably one of the most extreme state of the state addresses in the country. I mean, in the sense that it she's really laying out what might be the most socialist agenda, leftist agenda that is set forth at any state level that I know of, right? And that includes places like New York and California and these places, okay? I talked about this on Tuesday night. Our friend Alan from WBOB 990 was nice enough to invite me on and talk about a few things. So I want to thank him for that. If you have a chance, go listen to Rhode Island Red Radio on WBOB990.com. It's a great show. And we talked about this a little bit and the idea that what was her purpose of doing this? Because I mean, actually, I got to be honest with you. I was looking at the reaction. Like, there were certain things where it seemed like a lot of people stood up and clapped and stuff, but there were certain things where they panned around and there were a lot of Democrats sitting there who you could tell were kind of eye rolling it. You know, like, they're just kind of like, oh, what is this? You know, and look, she knows that even if this stuff doesn't go through, she can blame the legislature. She can get her socialist leftist street cred under her belt, which she's been struggling to sort of show off ever since the pension crisis and everything, especially and road works and things like that. She's really trying to show her progressive cred. Mm-hmm. And who knows if she's looking at a presidential run at some point in the future or what. But she can always point back to what she tried to do or what she said she wanted to do. And it's just, it's so political. And this is what the problem when you have people making political decisions in areas that really should have nothing to do with politics, like education or the marketplace and economics. You know, you start throwing politics into it and you make bad, stupid choices.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we should just go over a couple of the main points that she made. And the first one I see on our list here is universal pre-K, right? So now not only are we expanding our government indoctrination from K through 12, we're adding pre-K to it, and we'll get to the other one here in a minute. But so now we're going into pre-K, right? So,
yeah, it sounds good. Right. Like, oh, let's, you know,
the children,
let's take care of the children. Right. And every child should have access to pre-K and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, yeah, it sounds great. But what you end up doing when you do these things, at first, you know, it doesn't seem like a huge cost. But what's going to happen is that when they start being able to outcompete, obviously, the private preschools,
right,
and a lot of them start shutting down. More and more people are going to have to come into the system. It's going to cost more and more money, and the quality is going to drop. The costs are going to rise. Okay. And when I say the cost, not the cost to the person sending the kid to the preschool, obviously, right, for most of them, but to the actual cost to the state, to the tax base, right?
Right.
There is still a cost there, and that cost will go up to an extreme level. There was a comment on Twitter that one of the progressives made. For the life of me, I can't remember who it was in the state house. But they were talking about the universal pre-K saying, it wasn't universal pre-K. It was the college, which we're going to talk about, too, going forward. But it just goes to this argument of free this and free that. That's not really free. Saying that we were going to have the most affordable college in the country. Well, affordable for who?
For who?
No. It's the most affordable for people sending their kids there to that special interest. Sure. But to everybody else, it's going to be the most expensive college program in the country. you know, so it's just it's this crappy way that they like to make these things look, to make it look better than it really is, and actually to make it look good, period. And it's not good.
Yeah. The two things on the pre-K, that one comes to mind. You mentioned the, you know, the private pre-Ks that are, you know, in business now. We have a friend, a mutual friend, Anna Lee, who ran for state rep in District 69 in Bristol and Portsmouth, and was beat by a commie, Susan Donovan, one of the progressives in the radical caucus.
Yeah, she's all over this universe.
The tax and spend caucus. But right, exactly. But you know, she owns a day, like her real job, she owns a daycare, and my son actually went there all through until he went into kindergarten.
Oh,
and,
really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Cool. I used to take him there, you know, every day on the way to work, and
that's really nice when you get excellent. Someone you know.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, I trust. You know, I grew up with Annalie, went to high school together, and so I trust. You know, I trust her, and she ran a great business. But what's that going to do to her now? You know what the impact on her? It's hard to compete with. Again, I'm using air quotes here, free, taxpayer subsidized or funded competition, right? Again, cronyism. It's right.
She's competing with the subsidization.
Right.
Right. She's it is really a mistake for us to say that it's free preschool. It is actually a much better way to say that she's going to have to compete with preschools that are getting huge chunks of taxpayer funded money, a revenue stream that is unlimited, right. Basically. They can get as much as they want whenever they want, and she doesn't have that advantage.
No. And then the second point is the indoctrination, right? Even earlier now. Now we're doing it even earlier in the life cycle of of public education, which we're going to talk about later here in the podcast. Yep. In more in depth. But again, you know, so now you're even further when they're in their very formative years.
Yeah, and you might think, okay, how much can you really indoctrinate a 2 to 3 year old, right? I guess it would be more like a 4 or 5 year old, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, you see these stories around the country, and it's the kind of stuff that they push in a lot of these kids who are as young as 4 or 5 or 6 are wildly out of the mainstream, especially, you know, socially speaking. And you know, look, I think that bottom line is that it eliminates choice. Right. You have a friend who runs a preschool who you trust, who you think does great work. She might have her own philosophy mm-hmm. that you happen to agree with, and you want to make the choice. That's where you want to send your kid. That choice is going to be stripped away from you. It really is. I mean, and basically what happens is the same thing we see with private schools and public schools now, where there will still be private schools. There will still be private pre-Ks. There will still be private preschools, but they will be much more expensive. And they will be geared towards people who have, you know, our upper middle class, more so than just middle class. And you know, it takes choice away from the masses. So not
only they're going to do it pre-K, they're looking to do it post high school. So college. So now we already have CCRI, right? 2 years at CCRI, and that now they want to expand that to the final 2 years at RIC.
Right.
So you can transfer to RIC and continue.
Yeah. And I think she actually also said in the speech, and you wouldn't know this from the news articles, but she also said that before her 4 years are over, she wants to expand it to URI as well.
That's right. I remember that.
And what was so interesting about the speech, and I don't know if you just listened to it or if you watched it, but I watched it. Yeah. And the presidents of RIC and CCRI were off their chairs, out of their seats. The president of URI was clapping along, but he was conspicuously not standing for this proposal, which I thought was fascinating. Now, maybe he's got an injury or something. He can't stand. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I thought that was very telling. He, you know, he looked very skeptical. And, you know, look, this is her baby. This is also, you know, part of this, too, is it's not so much even it is the indoctrination piece of it, but it's also about getting more and more people in the state dependent on the state and using state resources so that they are more likely to vote for the people who want to propagate that system. So now you add in pre-K. Now you're getting people in earlier into, you know, relying on the government for a service that's a very important service, right? That is integral to their life. Same thing with college. Now you've got these kids who are new voters mm-hmm. who, you know, instead of leaving the government service or leaving the government subsidy of education that they're getting at 18, right when they turn to, they start to vote, right? You're able to try to entice them to stay in the state, go to a state college for free, you know, with this promise of free tuition down the road, and now they can vote.
Yeah.
Right. So this is all part of it too. It's so cynical. It's so political. And
yeah, here's another concern of mine is that standards, right? So they need to show success in order to get buy-in for this, right? So they're already claiming success on, you know, whatever metrics that they're using. But one has to wonder whether or not the standards are being lowered in order to show success, right? So you're making it easier for people to get through this. Because I know early on there was definitely, and I didn't look into this as of the latest statistics, but early on there was a lot of question about the success of the program, people signing up and dropping out and not, you know, yep, grades not being up to par and all this other stuff. But then all of a sudden in her speech, she's saying that there's all these metrics for success. Again, I haven't verified whether or not they're true, but
they were super vague.
Yeah. Too. You have super to vague. Wonder if they are true, were the standards lower so they could show, again, it's a state institution. So if she's, we all know how that works, right? You come into my office, you need to show success. Otherwise you're going to be finding a job kind of thing. Right.
Right.
So you got to wonder, about that as well. That's a little bit conspiratorial, but it's,
you know what? It's really it's not, real. It's really not, Mike. It's politics.
Yeah.
Right. One thing that, a state rep told me, I was communicating with who, I won't say who it is. Because you know, they didn't know I was going to talk about this, but, I was talking to a state rep, who about the state of the state address. And, I sent him a picture that I had taken of the crowd and all the people standing. And he said, "Do you see this blonde woman in the front row?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you know who that is?" I said, "No, I don't know who it is." He goes, "She used to work for the Projo and she was exposing a lot of stuff about DCYF and the stuff that the problems they were having over there and stuff that was going on. The governor hired her to be part of her PR team. And now she's up there standing, applauding, clapping along with everything she's saying," right? It's not conspiracy. It's politics. Keep your enemies close. This person is ripping me up and down. Instead of fighting her, why don't I just make her a part of my team and give her a pay and put her on the payroll? So, I mean, so it's not conspiratorial at all, I don't think, what you're saying. And I think that the other thing too is this just happened recently. Go Local put out a story about the, I believe it was the head of the faculty at CCRI who was very critical of this Rhode Island Promise thing. And part of the reason was is that there's such a high percentage of kids who are dropping out after the first year. And he recently was fired from his, not from his job as a faculty member, but from his department chair position. And they gave what he says are all these bogus reasons for why they decided to do it. But it's pretty clear, basically, and he's going to get a lawyer, he said, but it's pretty clear that the reason was because he's been very vocally against this program. And the president of CCRI that Gina put in place is super behind it, obviously. So, you know, look, retribution is real. Elections have results, all these things. This is why, as libertarians, we don't want a state government or politics involved in these things, right? Because look what who's losing out. It's the kids.
Yeah.
The kids are losing.
Slightly
taxpayers are losing.
Right. Slightly off topic, but on point is Mattiello's appointments for all the committee positions, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. The commie caucus, you know, they all got booted. Jason Knight got kicked off of judiciary. Like, all these people lost their positions, their chairmanships and all this stuff.
Well,
again,
what do you expect?
And he's saying it's not in retribution. Yeah, right.
See, okay. Well, that's his mistake.
You think I'm that stupid.
There's his mistake. He should just say, look, you can use the word retribution if you want. But what it really is the fact that these people don't want to be a part of my team. Basically, by voting against me, they don't believe with my vision. It's my power to stock the committees, and to put the chairs in place. I'm going to put the people in who are part of my team.
Yeah.
And look, that's... it's really not that crazy that he would do that. And you've got people saying, you know, that he's acting like a dictator. And look, the speaker has way too much power. There's no doubt about it. But he's not a dictator because he's putting his people in the positions to run the committees that are under his, you know, jurisdiction. So it just makes sense.
Yeah.
So another thing that came up in this address as well, again, which I was just shocked with like thing after thing that kept coming up. This path to a $15 minimum wage. Yeah. She wants to raise it to over $11 this coming year. And then, but I think she said within 3 years, it would be at $15.
Insane. Right. Again, this is something we get pushed back all the time on, yeah, the site. And again, it's for them, it's from largely from the commies that troll us. Some of the Republicans, you know, it's, and even Democrats, people don't understand economics, basic economics. And if Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, just read it.
Best book ever.
Just read it.
Just read it.
Actually, shoot us a message on an email. If you want a free copy, send us an email. I've got a box.
Look at that.
Right up there on the shelf, probably about 30, you know, 15, 20 copies.
Wow. I haven't counted them. Free stuff.
So
look, free stuff, everybody.
First come, first serve. If you want a copy of the book, shoot us an email, mike@libertyri.com, and I will, with your address, and I'll send you a free copy.
It's a great book. But the thing is this kind of goes along with the sort of the Ocasio-Cortez, the thing about, you know, you don't need to be factually right, just morally right. You know, right. It doesn't matter if a $15 minimum wage is basically going to be just a job killer. It's going to do a number of things. And I think that it's important, as someone who knows a little bit about small business, what an ever increasing minimum wage does is it like in any budget, it's going to force business owners to have to cut back somewhere, right? Or try to raise their revenues. One thing that people often say is that, well, it's going to be passed on to the consumer. This is a bit of a fallacy, actually, because you have to assume that most businesses are already charging the most that they possibly can charge to get the most revenue they can, right? So the idea is that, let's say, you know, you're selling a carton of milk and you're selling it for $2.50, right? That price comes about over millions of exchanges in the marketplace between people with money and people with milk, right? And it arrives at that price because that is the most likely price that someone will buy milk at,
right?
Okay, so if you raise it too high above that, you know, you might think, okay, well, I'm raising the price, I'm gonna make more money, but less people are going to buy it, so you might actually make less money,
right?
So the idea that people will just get passed on to the consumer isn't necessarily true. It might be true because if you raise a cost for everybody all at once, then if everyone raises their price all at once,
everyone's raising it,
then that might happen. Shit. But what's most likely to happen is that either businesses will cut quality, they'll try to cut corners places to save money, or they'll cut jobs. And that's the most likely thing, especially with small businesses that are family run, is they'll just keep it more in the family. I love how her rationale for this was that we have to be competitive with Connecticut and Massachusetts in terms of having a higher minimum wage. Like, she really used the word competitive for raising the minimum wage. That's going to make us more competitive,
right?
You know, she studied economics. She was a Rhodes, right? She was a Rhodes scholar, right? I mean, she is a Keynesian economist. If you don't know what Keynesianism is, it's basically, it's the idea that deficit spending, big government spending is good for the economy. Yeah. That's her to a T.
The whole broken window fallacy.
Broken window fallacy that, you know, that creates economic activity, so it's good for the economy. But, you know, how it's basically just a huge fallacy. It's the same thing. The minimum wage is basically like breaking a window.
Yeah.
Look, people are going to lose jobs, and it's going to put more people on the dole. Look, one thing she cited in the speech as evidence of our great economic success in the state since she took office is the unemployment numbers and how they've gone, you know, that we have more jobs. We have more people working more jobs than ever before. Well, you know what? I'd hope so. I really hope that we don't have the same number of jobs in a market, so supposedly market economy, that we had 20 years ago,
yeah,
or that we had 10 years ago. And, you know, but at the same time, there's actually more people collecting government assistance in the state than ever before as well. So what does that tell you?
Yep.
What it tells me is that she's created probably a lot more government jobs, a lot more temporary jobs with her road work and things like that, seasonal jobs, things like that, part-time jobs, you know, where, you know, look, if you're going to hire someone and you're forced to pay them $12 an hour as opposed to $9 an hour, maybe you only hire them 30 hours a week, you know? So it's the same thing. It's like, yeah, okay, you might be making more per hour, but you might be working less hours. It's the same thing with the prices. It's just a price. It's a wage is just a price.
Right. Yeah. So, and we will hit minimum wage, I'm sure, more as time goes on. We'll probably cover it more in depth when the topic comes up. I'm sure it will. We're got a couple more segments here to do. So real quick, gun bans. Yeah, assault weapons ban. She mentioned something else. Again, we kind of figured that was going to be coming, but it's you know, it just never ends.
That actually got probably the most lukewarm response in the room.
Yeah.
As anything. Yeah. So there was that. There was the doubling small business loans and more corporate welfare. Of course, that's not going to change.
Yeah. And final thing, I just wanted, because this linked, her speech linked directly to the budget, which was released, I believe, two or three days later. That was a Thursday, I think. You know, so it, with when people started analyzing the budget, I'd be honest, I haven't dug in and do it myself. So all the stuff I found was through articles. But we've got a list of taxes here. So we've got a tax on downloads and streaming, aka the Netflix tax, which is, again, taxing people's basic creature comforts, right? So I think she'll get pushback on that because people tend not to like that. Although we did see some people complaining, oh, what's the big deal? It's just a Netflix tax. Nothing is going to be 60 cents or whatever. Again, it's the fact that they're willing to go to that length to tax the movies you watch on your TV. Do you not understand that?
That's a huge mistake.
It's like the issues we bring up with the shoveling snow and you know, like that's how, plastic bags. That's how far they're going to control your life. They're going to tax your movies. So then
that's actually a dumb move on her part because the thing that's keeping people distracted from how hard they're getting screwed is the movies on Netflix and all the stuff. Now you're gonna put it in their face there too.
Yeah. So then we got the beach tax, which is a fee hike, the campground tax, another fee hike, DMV tax, another fee increase. I'm calling these taxes, but that's really what they are. She wants to scale back the car tax relief, which they're trying to implement. She wants to scale that back. They raise the minimum, the cigarette tax, which is to the highest in the country, which I'm not a cigarette smoker, but you know,
$4.60 tax on an item that costs $11 is a huge tax.
Right. A lobbying tax, an interior design tax if you're an interior designer, landscaping tax, a rod and gun club tax, Medicaid tax on employers. So there's again, that's complicated, but adding a health insurance mandate and a pot tax.
Of course, which
brings us into our next
perfect segue.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, oh God, this taxes. So, of course, the other big news that came out was that Gina is going to be backing legalized pot. And I don't like to call it legalized pot. I like to call it regalized pot, meaning, you know, that this is going to be an industry controlled by the crown.
Yeah.
The way that she has this proposed. And it really is outside of energy, you know, like National Grid, seems like it'll be the closest thing to a state-run industry that we've ever seen to this point, especially as something that's sort of like a retail type operation, right? As opposed to like an industrial operation for the most part. You know, and I smoked cannabis in my younger days. I'm definitely not an expert on it. But even just to my eye, my sort of untrained eye, This legislation is going to fail massively if it's implemented.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got, I mean, it's just, when you start looking at it again, it's this huge regulatory structure. And again, we get pushback on this. We should just read some of the comments we get on the Facebook page, but we get pushback on this about, you know, what about the, you know, people driving stoned and all this. I'm like, do you realize people who want to smoke pot are already smoking pot? It's not very hard to get.
And driving.
Right. Like, so making it legal is not going to change that, right? It's for, you know, quote unquote, for safety is a BS argument. It's just people who want to do it are already doing it, you know? Right. So, and then she wants to, of course, obviously tax it, which just gives more money to all those programs that she wants to fund, which is not... not within the purview of government. Like, government shouldn't be doing that. So whether or not often people, especially even people who agree with quote unquote legalization on the right, will say, well, we'll just tax the hell out of it, which again, points to them not being fiscally conservative, right? That's just a, you know, a fallacious argument. But so they're going to use all this money to fund things that they're not supposed to, then they shouldn't be doing. So don't do it. Like, just don't tax it. What? Because you don't need the money. You've got a spending problem, not a taxation problem, not a revenue problem.
Right. And
but they do have a taxation problem.
That's for sure. And it totally undercuts her safety argument as well. And that was her big thing. She's like, well, we're not doing this for the money. We're doing it for the safety. Well, then why the hell would you institute a system where you legalize, quote unquote, legalize something, where you're basically ensuring that any black market that does exist will continue to exist and probably continue to thrive? Because what are you going to do, Mike, when, you know, especially if, and obviously I don't have no clue what your drug habits are. No,
I don't smoke pot.
but you know, I'm assuming that people who, you know, have a dealer that they go to, that they get their cannabis from or whatever, that they trust and they know already, you know, are they going to go to the pot shop that, you know, that is selling it for, you know, $25 more per, eighth of an ounce or whatever it is now.
I don't know what the market
is. You know, then they can get it on the street. I mean, why would they do that? Yeah. Especially when they're already getting it. It's already decriminalized. You know, so you're basically ensuring that the safety aspect of it that you're trying to claim is going to be the safety will be increased. You're not going to. Now, if you actually legalized it, the safety aspect would actually come into play.
Right.
Then you'd get rid of the black market. You'd have people using, you know, the marketplace would regulate. You know, no one is going to go to a shop that's poisoning people, right? Because they can go to a bunch of other shops that are out in the open and it's not clandestine and it's, you know, whatever. But that's not what this is. That's not what this program is at all. And then what about the edible thing, Mike? I don't get the dosages and stuff, but I heard a lot of people saying that there's like a 5 milligram limit on the edibles and that literally won't even get you high.
Right. Yeah. I don't know much about it. This is an episode we should get our co-moderator John on. He's up to speed on the technical sides of this, more so than I am. But I that's my understanding as well. You know, the dosage that they're looking at limiting are very, you know, why would you pay that much money to get no effect? That makes sense.
And someone said on the radio the other day, it was like, I hate to break it to you, but people are doing this stuff to get high.
Right.
They're not doing it just because it is what it is. Like, they want a brownie. No, they want a brownie to get high.
Yeah.
That's why they're doing it.
Yeah. And I don't like, I'll drink good beer to for the taste of beer, you know, not just to get drunk, but because I enjoy the taste, but I'm not eating gummy bears for the flavor. Right. Like, right. And comparing different gummy bears. If I'm going to eat an edible gummy bear, that's got some kind of effect to me, I'm going to make sure I get something out of it. Right.
Like, have you tried those creme brulee, gummy bears?
Yeah.
So, have you tried the truffle, the truffle gummy bears? That's a good point.
So another thing, just shooting back to safety real quick. I was listening to Dan York on one of the nights on, as much as I can stand him, but I turned the radio on the way home from work, and he was talking about something about police chiefs wanting to get in on this, and have input and all this other stuff. And he was objecting to the idea that somebody was saying that, no, they shouldn't have input because the police departments execute the laws that they're given. They shouldn't have say in creating law.
They're not legislators. Like,
they're not legislators. Right. But even beyond that, any objection the police department would have to this, I would be suspect to, because my guess is as soon as Rhode Island legalizes, they lose federal funding and grants, you know, for law enforcement, for drug. And they get a lot of money. A
lot of fancy toys. They get with all that money.
All their Humvees and, you know, I don't know if, I don't think Rhode Island has any armored vehicles yet. They may. I have not looked at it.
I can tell you for sure. I know that Johnston for sure has got armored stuff in there. The Johnston Police Department. I know for sure.
Johnston is.
I wrote an article. I wrote an article on it a few years ago.
I know they had Humvees and stuff. And I saw they had like.
They've got some armored stuff.
Yeah, okay.
So they're armored Humvees, yeah. I think.
Well,
they have a SWAT team, Mike.
Yeah. There's a whole another topic.
They practice on the football field.
But the funny thing is, a lot of, and this is a complete side tangent here. A lot of these police departments will get this equipment through the government programs. The problem is, once they get it, they've got to maintain it, and they don't have the funds to maintain it because it's expensive to maintain that stuff. It breaks. I mean, I haven't been in the military. The vehicles break down constantly because they get, you know, especially those vehicles, they're not driven around every day. So they you know, seals are leaking and you know, all that.
Which by the way, is it, you know, when we talk about guns, when people say, you think that someone should just be able to own a tank? Who the hell is going to be able to afford a tank?
That's right.
Idiot. And afford to be able to keep it up and buy the ammunition. I mean, you'd have to be a multi.
Yeah. And people can't own a tank, right? But they're rich people, right?
But if you have that much money, maybe you do need a tank. Right. Who the hell knows? I don't know. But that's a good point. I mean, they can't maintain this stuff. They just, it ends up sitting there and rotting away anyway.
And so. So the other part of this is you're not allowed to grow recreational plants. So it prevents you from growing vegetation. Like, you cannot grow a plant in your home. And now this ties in and carries over into the medical cannabis debate, or not debate, but policy that she had proposed, I believe, following this, where she wants to increase the amount of compassion centers in the state, but she wants to decrease and heavily restrict medical patients from growing their own plants. And as well, she wants to increase the taxes that the sales tax you pay at the dispensary, the compassion center, and increase the surcharges the compassion centers pay to the government. So she's further taxing, which she already taxes people's medicine. It's just insanity. A friend of ours, Pat Ford, who many people probably heard on the radio, has a line that he uses where the woman's evil. If she's willing to tax the sick and dying, people that are at some of the worst points in their lives, final resort, nothing else is working. They've, you know, gone to medical cannabis to help relieve their pain and suffering, because they don't want to get hooked on opioids, right? Which is another problem. She wants to tax them. What kind of evil person does that?
I mean, taxes are evil to begin with, because they're coercion. But you're right. How many taxes do you pay on your meds, Mike? And Mike, the meds that you need,
right?
There's no other medications that are taxed like that.
When I get antibiotics for whatever cold, you know, or. Yeah,
it's cold, crazy.
Cold's a virus.
All right, it's crazy. And it's like, how about like the idea that, you know, obviously like people don't have the resources to make antibiotics in their house, but there's lots of stuff that people use for home remedies, herbal teas and stuff that people can grow in their yard and stuff all the time. This is something that people actually have the capacity to be able to grow themselves and basically use as a home remedy. And you're taking that freedom away from them, which is absolutely 1,000% criminal. And you know, I really hesitate to use the word evil. That's a tough one for me, but it really is hard to avoid that idea, because it's what other motivation do you have? Now here's a question I have, actually. Maybe we can get a little philosophical here, because one of my hangups with these sorts of things is when it comes to children, right? Because as an anarcho-capitalist sort of, you know, a voluntarist, you know, person, I don't believe there should be any regulation in the market by a state or anything. One thing I was wondering about is that, you know, if as a parent, you have certain rights over your kids, right? And I think parental rights is something that we believe.
Right, and responsibilities.
Yeah. And so I actually do think that, you know, I think Pat had said something like about regulating like broccoli. Well, a kid can go in the store and buy broccoli, right?
Right.
You know, I think that as a parent, you know, maybe there's a certain point where if you want to allow your child to do it, that's one thing. But, you know, I don't know if kids, you know, kids shouldn't just be allowed to buy alcohol with especially without a parental approval. I think that's where I get kind of hung up sometimes. I'm not sure. I was wondering what you think about that.
No, I'm in the same boat as you. It's one of those issues that you've got to kind of struggle with.
Right.
But again, I think it really does go back to the parent, like the parent's responsibility to look out for their children and raise them properly. And
right.
Now, of course, the argument is going to be, well, some parents are bad parents, right? And you know what? Guess what? Those kids, and I don't even want to say bad parents have good parents don't have kids that drink. I drank.
Right.
I drank when I was a teenager.
Right.
Right. And I got alcohol fine. You know, right. I got it no problem. So kids who want to get it are going to get it anyway, and they're going to sneak behind their parents' back. And you know, so if maybe a market solution is leave it up to the shop owner, you know, have the shop owner who is an ethical person say,
right.
I won't sell to you. You know, I'm not going to sell to anybody under 18 or 21 right.
Well,
or whatever they determine.
Well, it's a consent issue.
Yeah. And people can lobby those business owners to make sure that they provide that stopgap. You know,
yeah, parents can get together and form parents groups and stuff and go to these a shop that they feel is being a bad actor and demand action. But it really is, it's a consent issue. And if the idea is that children can't consent to certain things until a certain age, then honestly, in a sense, I don't really want someone selling my kid anything until I say it's okay, even if it's broccoli.
Yeah.
Like, what if my son stole $10 off my dresser and ran down to the store to buy some sugary crap that I don't want him to eat? You know, should you really be selling a 10-year-old who's by themselves sugar without their parents, for what you know, for no, you know, any intents and purposes, their say so? So I think there is actually a libertarian argument there. When it comes to children and protecting children, but also protecting the rights of the parents.
Yeah.
Right. So it was just something I really had been thinking a lot about with this topic. And so I wanted to bring it up.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So yeah, we'll wrap that up again. Another topic I'm sure we'll be revisiting as it starts to pop up and we actually start reading legislation and seeing what comes out, you know, from this. Right now it's just kind of a proposal, but, next topic is a viewer or listener submitted from Aaron, who is a follower on the Liberty RI Facebook page. He had submitted this a couple weeks back.
Do the snow the shoveling one?
Who he did? Aaron's like he, yeah, that's right. He did.
Aaron, you're a star in terms of picking
good topics. And this one we got to a little bit later, and it's been going on since November, so it's kind of you know, gone through this whole evolution, but it's about the. One of the school board members in South Kingstown that was recently elected to the school board. Her name is Sarah Markey. She was elected to the school board, and she's also one of the executive directors of the NEARI, so National Education Association, Rhode Island, which is essentially the teachers union, most powerful teachers union, I think, in the country.
Yep.
She's the Rhode Island chapter of that. So, stepping back a little bit, I believe last year or just prior to it, they had an opening on the board. So the board has the authority prior to an election to fill that position, essentially, you know, hire somebody, if you will.
It's like filling a vacancy.
Fill a vacancy. And she was one of the people that they were considering filling this vacancy. So they asked their counsel, their lawyer, whether or not this would be a conflict of interest. And the lawyer had responded. This lawyer is Sarah Rapport. I don't know. It's probably French.
Rapport sounds nicer.
like you know, Stephen Colbert.
Rapport.
Anyway, so this lawyer wrote an opinion saying persons represented by NEARI comprise 90% of all union members employed by the committee. And since the salaries benefits make up around 2/3 of the committee's annual budget, Markey's ability to fully participate may be impaired. So there's an obvious conflict of interest there, right? So to her members, the members of the organization she represents, this school board is their boss, essentially. So your boss is also an executive director of the union that argues on your lobbies on your behalf, right? So represents you, I guess is a good way to put it.
That's a conflict,
right? you think there's a conflict there? So
a little bit.
I didn't read any further whether or not she got appointed. I don't believe she did. But she did get elected to the board, right? Not only did she get elected, she also was appointed vice chair. So elected within the committee and appointed vice chair. Now, I will say, she said something else here. It says, I'm forging new ground here. There hasn't been a staff union person in any record that I can find who is elected to a school committee, she said. However, if you look at the recent Ethics Commission rulings, it's pretty clear you can't vote on bargaining agreements, you can't vote on discipline of a member, and you can't vote on grievances or terminations. Doesn't leave much for you to vote on, but...
nothing of a lot of substance, anyway.
Yeah, right. And you cannot tell me that anything she did vote on, she wouldn't have influence on, or anything she couldn't vote on, she didn't have influence on the other board members, right? She's got direct connection to them, and she can...
And you're telling me the union doesn't have an opinion on every single little thing that the school committee votes on and does? I mean, the whole, it's so blatantly corrupt So
she was elected vice chair in a seven person board. She was five people voted for her, two people abstained or recused.
Wow.
One of them stated that they wanted a legal opinion before voting her in there.
That's smartest person there.
So. So it goes deeper, right? So they had this little meeting, and then a couple days later, they have their actual board meeting, right? So it's 1 week later, and in this board meeting, wouldn't you know, they decide that one of the topics on the agenda is they want to fire the council, the person who recommended that opinion prior to that they don't think she should be on the board. Now, all of a sudden, they want to fire the council, right? Who, again, it gets a little more complicated. There's an ongoing lawsuit within the school district. Their lawyer has been fighting that. So there'd be a continuity issue if they fired them. So that was something that people were bringing up. But not only that, at the meeting, there were a bunch of people there that were against firing the council. They decided to stop public comment, to cut off public comment. After they had done that, there was some more issues raised. They decided, well, let's table this for now, and we'll vote on it at another time.
It's almost like the way you would envision a school board acting if it was run by a union.
So they pushed it off for a couple days, and wouldn't you know, they voted on it, and then they fired the council.
See ya.
So now the council's gone. The person that was right. So I thought that was quite interesting.
What town is this again?
South Kingstown.
South Kingstown. Man, South Kingstown's killing it with snow shoveling and union led school boards and plastic bag bans and all kinds of crap. Yeah.
So I thought that was quite interesting. We'll put a bunch of links in the show notes to that.
It's definitely a story to keep an eye on. And I think that, one thing I know is that a lot of this stuff is actually more commonplace than you think. Not a staff member being like this blatant, you know what I mean? But there's lots of active teachers who get on school boards, right, who are union members and things like that. So it's definitely something to keep an eye on, and I think that we will. Going forward.
Yeah. So this kind of ties into the last topic here, and it's School Choice Week. So
yay!
Interesting. I didn't realize school choice. Well, I didn't know it. I went to an event last year, but I went to an event this year. I went on two nights ago. I went to an event, AFF, our friends over Larry and his group, America's Future Foundation, I believe is AFF. They have monthly meetups, and it's pretty cool. It's kind of a mix of libertarians and conservatives.
Did you have a good time?
I had a good time. Yeah. I had a lot of good conversation. So, yeah. So they did a topic on school choice, right? So Justin Cass from the Center for Freedom and Prosperity came up and he did a speech. I guess he'd done a bunch of research on school choice, and he was also at the one the previous year, and some of us libertarians in the audience had objected to some of what he was saying, so he was kind of prepared to counter some libertarian sentiment.
Well, I think we appreciate preparation.
Right. So he started off his presentation, and I'm not going to bash the guy. Like people have their positions and whatnot.
So, yeah, we could disagree, but right. I'm not bashing anyone.
He started off with this social contract theory, right? That we have an obligation as a society to educate our children so they become good citizens and da 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 da. So I lucky enough to get the last question of the evening to him. So I presented after everybody had gotten their back and forth with him. I presented to him. So if this is a moral issue, right? So we're talking about we have a moral obligation. How can you push a moral issue using an immoral, thing? Being taxes, right?
Yeah, the means. If the right. means are, it's an end and, justifies and, the means right. argument. It's a right. socialist argument.
So, what's more moral? Is it immoral to put a gun to somebody's head saying you are forced to now pay to educate these children, whether you have children or not, whether that's irrelevant. So you're using an argument to say a morality argument. And trying to achieve that moral goal with an immoral act.
Right.
Right. And in my opinion, an immoral act that outweighs the morality of
right.
What you're trying to accomplish.
Well, there's two aspects to this, right? So there's the moral aspect, right? And then there's the economic aspect in the sense that, and this has always been a tough issue for me because I never really felt like I understand it, but I feel like I'm getting a better grasp on it now. And, you know, it sounds good on the surface. It sounds like a libertarian idea, choice, school choice. And a lot of it obviously is in the messaging.
Yeah.
But it almost seems like, what are they going to do? They're going to basically turn private high schools and things, elementary schools and whatnot, into sort of what private colleges have become, which is overpriced, subsidized institutions through loans and different government grants and things. Right, that just distort the system.
Right. So the gist of the rest of his presentation was basically talking about school choice and how to fund school choice and alternative. You know what we can how we can move from that. And but we've always heard vouchers as a thing. Especially from conservatives, vouchers, and even some libertarians use vouchers as a way to fund education and allow parents to take their children to schools, either outside the district or right. private school, et cetera. All essentially, it's like food stamps for education, right? So it
right,
it allows,
right, it, right. You That's know, a great analogy.
Yeah. So it gives you taxpayers, pay in. You get a voucher from the government to worth X amount of dollars, and that goes towards either your tuition or it's transferred to the alternative school that you go to. If it's another public school, say a charter school or a other school like that. Right. So that's largely fallen out of favor in a lot of conservative circles. So one of the arguments is a moral argument, right? Why should tax dollars be going to, say, a Catholic school? So a person's paying tax dollars and they're going to a Catholic school and the government's transferring the money to the Catholic school. And this, so there could be a moral objection to that, right? And I'm just using Catholic school as an example.
Sure.
So that kind of has largely fallen off. So another scheme, if you will, that's popped up is these what's called education savings accounts, where the money is put into an account and the parent has access to that account, and then that parent makes the payment. So it's kind of like a savings account. They draw the money out and they pay the thing. So they're saying that's masking the parents making the payment, which is another BS argument. The fund is, the money is still there. A fraction of that money for me is still there and going to a school that I don't.
What's the difference if you're giving it to the parent first? It's just one more step.
Right. There's no difference. Right. So there's that argument, that moral argument. Right. But it also, if you think about it, it's just another form of cronyism, right? So if you've got a private, and I think you hit on this, if you've got a private school that is now getting taxpayer dollars, do you think they're going to want to give, let me step back a little bit. A lot of the argument is we need a transition from public education to a more market-based system.
I'm all for that.
Right. And they're saying this is that transition, right? But what will happen is, just like in business, if a company gets hooked on government money, they don't want to give up the government money. So what you're going to do is when you try to transition to the more market-based system, all these private schools now are going to be acting like public schools, saying, no, we want the tax dollars, right? Because it's like they're hooked on the drug, right? It's you know, it's a revenue stream for them. So
that they don't have to work for, really. They just need influence and favors.
Right.
You know, they don't have to actually perform a service to get it.
Right, right. So anyway, so I made another point. I brought up another point, we've got a socialized education system, right? That is what it is. It's a single payer education system, yep. Right? So, and the argument is based on morality. We need this system to for the children, right? To educate the children so they become good citizens and they become productive members of society. And somehow it's justified to use force to do that, to produce that. Well, the same argument can also be said for healthy citizens, right? Healthy children. We need a healthy society so everybody can thrive and be healthy and live in. So can you use the same argument to justify a socialized healthcare system?
It seems like you could.
And I got crickets.
Right. Right.
So it was, you know, you cannot square those two. If you are against socialized healthcare, but you're for socialized education, how do you square those?
It doesn't work. I think your food stamp analogy is really right on. It's food choice. Right. You know, I mean, it's the same thing. And honestly, a lot of businesses right now, I mean, some of them, you know, rely on EBT and SNAP and different thing payments for like 25% of their revenues. I mean,
No, as a libertarian anarcho-capitalist, I think the whole system should just be abolished, right? But I understand the 95% or 99% of the people, 99.9% of the people don't get that, right? There needs to be some kind, even if you do agree with transitioning to a market-based system, there needs to be some way to transition to that system, right? You know, wean yourself off the government system into a more privatized system. So, the two methods, again, like I said, were vouchers and savings accounts. But those involve coercion, force, right? So there's another system that has been, you know, discussed and developed. Cato is a big proponent of this, and you and I being Misesians don't always agree with Cato, but they do some good work. And again, I'll always give credit where good work is done. And they have this idea of education tax credits, right? So what an education tax credit does, and there's kind of two forms of it. One's a personal tax credit where if you have a child in private school, you get a tax credit for paying their tuition, right? The other one is the scholarship-based tax credit where if you're a person or business that donates to a scholarship fund for needs-based scholarships, you get a tax credit, right? Hmm. Everybody gets a tax credit. Tax credits for everybody. A little Oprah.
Yeah, you're like the Oprah of, the Oprah of school of, choice there.
of tax credits, right? So I did bring that up, and then they mentioned it. Now, Rhode Island does have a scholarship-based tax credit program where a business can give money to a scholarship and they get a tax credit. And in the case of Rhode Island, and we've talked about this in previous podcasts, it's capped at $1.5 million per year. So there's no more money can go in this system. It's limited at $1.5 million, and it's a max donation of $100,000 per business, if you will. And it's only for corporations, not for individuals. And they get a 75% tax credit for 1 year donation. And if they commit to 2 years, they get a 90% tax credit for doing that. But it's capped and it's restricted. So if you want to do, what is it? There's 15 companies. If you wanted to do a, 15 companies, yeah. If I do my math right, if they do the max donation, right?
Right.
And it's my understanding that they have more people every year than they wanting to do this than they are able to.
Right.
To
yeah. We talked, this is, was this Bob Lancia who wanted to?
I think.
Wanted to increase the cap, right?
Exactly. Try to increase the cap.
And they didn't go for it.
And they didn't go for it.
It does seem like an idea that if it was, you know, as long as it wasn't targeted towards specific schools or sort of like the corporate cronyism that we see with tax breaks and tax credits and things. If it's something that...
Well, I don't have a problem with corporations getting tax breaks.
Right.
That's another misconception with libertarianism.
Right.
I actually agree with if a company can get every single dime of their taxes back, I don't have a problem with that. The problem I have is when the government picks and chooses who can do it.
Exactly. And that's that's the point. Exactly. The point that I'm making. As long if it's something that anyone can achieve or anything anyone can apply for and get, regardless of who they are, then that's fantastic. You know, if it's something that they're doling out as a sort of reverse subsidization, that's different. But it does seem like that's a great way to transition. It seems like
it's 100% voluntary, right? I donate to the scholarship fund. I have, for example, if I have no children, I donate to a scholarship fund. It goes through a nonprofit. The government doesn't touch this money. So it goes through either directly to a scholarship at a particular school or through a nonprofit that does scholarships. They don't touch it, right? I pay my daughter's tuition at a private school. They don't touch it. It's going to the, and I just, when I file my taxes, I say I spend, you know, $30,000 in tuition. I get a, whatever the scheme. Now there's various, and I'm going to put a bunch of links in the show notes to this. So it's direct, you know, a voluntary, transaction. So the money that the tax credit is, so the argument I got back from this was, one of the arguments I got back from this was, well, that decreases the tax revenue that's available for, to fund other things. And I said, even better.
Oh, that's
even
a,
better.
That's a great argument.
Right. Like, you know,
I think what's so funny is too, is, you know, think about the person who's sending their kid to a private school. Think about the money they're saving the school district by doing that.
Right.
All right. And just even giving them, if it costs $16,000 per student. Now, obviously if your student, if your kid went to that school, it's not like it's, technically, you would think it would be an extra $16,000 for that student. It sometimes doesn't exactly work out that way. But I mean, if it wasn't for private schools, the public school system would be even worse shape than it is now. I mean, in terms of being able to handle the students. So it's an opt-out system, the one that you're describing.
That's right.
And it could work for, I think it could work for everything. And even fire protection, police services. Like if I want to opt out and I want to hire my own private security, you know, I should be able to do that and get a tax break if I do it. It's the same thing. So I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. Last thing I'll mention, because we're running out of time here, was I just found this in my research earlier this evening before we started the show, was a tax credit for savings for ESAs, for the education savings accounts. So grandma can contribute to the family's ESA. Again, this ESA is not tied to any tax. You know, it's not connected to a tax, but it's a mechanism for outside entities to donate into a college or a private or a education fund, if you will. And then that money can, again, be tax. I haven't read it totally. I'll leave a link so everybody else can read it as I read it. But I thought that was another potential good idea. Again, there's many ideas out there, like, and we're just hitting at a couple here.
Right.
But this is just one example of a in my mind, unless there's another libertarian out there that can see it's not voluntary, a purely voluntary transitional mechanism or alternative mechanism, as opposed to the vouchers and ESAs, which Liberty RI will never support and will always rail against.
Right. And I think that what's important too, and this is something that Rothbard, for those who don't know who Murray Rothbard is, sort of the grandfather of modern libertarianism, said, is that, you know, sometimes incrementalism is all you can get. But as long as you're explicit about what the end goal is, that's okay.
Right.
As long as you're saying, look, we want a system that's totally privatized, but this is a way to transition to it.
Right. So I'll just finish off with a couple names here. As far as libertarians go, Walter Block, another prominent, who is very well connected with Murray Rothbard before he passed, and continues to go on. And great guy. If you don't read Walter Block, you should. He's got a lot of great stuff.
He's brilliant.
Friedman, right? So vouchers goes back to Milton Friedman, and we post a lot of Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman's, I call him a gateway drug to libertarian ideas, right?
Yeah.
Or at least economic ideas.
He's a great messenger,
right? He was very well, very good, well spoken and whatnot. Milton Friedman supported vouchers, right? So that's where a lot of libertarians will connect to you know, vouchers being acceptable to Milton Friedman, but he also supported things like withholding tax, right? You know, payroll withholdings, you know, so you don't actually, that was one of the biggest, you know, contributors to people not getting mad when they have to write that check at the end of the year, right? Because their money just comes out of their paycheck. They never see it. They, never seen,
right.
You know, so anyway, so we give, again, Milton credit for where it's due, and anybody's not
criticized perfect, where it's due. As
and
well.
Walter Block wrote a great article, you know, kind of exposing all that, and I'll put that
in the show notes too.
Definitely, and great read.
Well, that's gonna do it for our show this week. Thanks for listening in. Again, please contact us on the Facebook page if you've got any ideas, questions, subjects you'd like us to cover. I think we've shown that we will definitely cover stuff that people would like to hear about. You know, hey, get on there. See if you can beat Aaron to the punch. You know, see if you can get something on there. Aaron's crushing it right now. So find us on the Facebook page and on Twitter, LibertyRI. You can also go to, of course, LibertyRI.com. That's our home base. You can also find us on any podcasting app that there exists, pretty much. iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can also email us directly, Eric@LibertyRI.com or Mike@LibertyRI.com. Don't forget to ask Mike about that free copy of Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. Fantastic book. We really look forward to talking to you guys next week. Health willing, God willing. We'll talk to you guys then. Take care.
You've been listening to the Rhode Island Liberty Report. Be sure to check us out at LibertyRI.com.